The content of this program is for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. Salute a Veteran Every Day is underwritten by RBR Physical Therapy. Are you in pain or discomfort? Start your journey of relief at RBR Physical Therapy, located at 1300 Corporation Parkway, Suite B, Raleigh. Call 919-917-7729 or visit us at www.rbrpt.com. Limp in, leap out.
Hello, I'm Janet with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Normally, you would be hearing the voice of Frank Urban, our volunteer who normally hosts this program. But today is different. Today, I will be the host and Frank will be the guest. Frank is a 22-year veteran of the U.S. Air Force. Welcome to Salute a Veteran Every Day, Frank.
Thank you, Janet. I feel right at home here.
I know you'd like to ask your guests where they have been stationed, so let's begin with that.
Yes, I do. You've been listening, I can tell. My very first assignment was the little town of Altus, Oklahoma, Altus Air Force Base. Thought I was going to die when I rolled into there in my little Volkswagen. I was 2 years there. Then I went to Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas, Nevada for 3 years. Wonderful assignment, doing video production. After that, I went to Clark Air Base in the Philippines for 2 years. Very exciting. After that, I got my choice of Hill Air Force Base, Utah, where, to this day, the best video production facility in the whole government, arguably, is there. After that, I had a special assignment with Eastman Kodak Company in Rochester, New York. I spent 1 year there under an Air Force program called Education with Industry. From there, I went to Norton Air Force Base in San Bernardino, California for 2 years. After that, I was selected for an assignment at the White House in Washington. That was very exciting, as you can imagine. Then at the Pentagon for a year, and then Hurlburt Field, Florida, near Fort Walton Beach, Florida, with the Air Force Special Operations Command. And then for my last assignment, back to Hill Air Force Base, Utah. Then I retired from the Air Force and retired to my hometown of Raleigh, and so here I am.
We are glad you made it back to Raleigh. Can you tell us how you got interested in videography and that technical aspect in the military?
Sure. Well, actually, I was interested in college. I majored in speech communication at NC State and worked my way through college in radio, working for AM radio station WRNC, which goes way back. And the big giant station back then was WKIX, Big Kicks. And in my junior year, I got a job there on the news desk. And I was just always interested in production. And although NC State didn't have a major, if they did, mine would have been in broadcasting.
Wonderful. We're very interested in hearing more about your time at the White House. Could you fill us more in on that?
Sure. Well, at that time, let me back up just a little bit to Altus. My first job was in personnel, which I thought was really boring after being a minor radio celebrity in Raleigh and knowing people everywhere I went. So, but actually it turned out to be the best thing that could have happened because I learned the personnel system, which that would serve me the rest of my career. And also I got out of personnel to get into the Aerospace Audiovisual Service, which is all the combat camera and video production and so forth. So that got me into that lane. And I was working at the headquarters in San Bernardino when we got a call from our big personnel center in Texas that we had to provide an officer to the White House to be commander of the audiovisual unit there. And I was taking the information because I was the executive officer to the commander, meaning kind of his right-hand man. And I was taking that information. My hand was shaking because I'm thinking, pick me, pick me. But my boss is the kind of guy that thought if you're trying to feather your own nest, you know, off with your head. You know, he was a very, very fair, even-tempered guy. So I had to go in there with the information that we've been tasked to provide an officer to the White House. And he didn't say, oh, would you like it, Frank? No, he just looked up at me very solemnly and said, give me a list of the top five you think we should nominate. So then I was like, oh, should I put my name first, my name last? If I don't put it first, he won't think I really want it. And I'm going through all that angst, and I finally decided, well, I'll put it alphabetically, which put me last. So I gave him the five names, and again, he didn't comment at all. He says, okay, send that down. So I send that down to the Military Personnel Center in San Antonio, and they said, well, we don't want five. We want two. So anyway, they looked at our records and picked two of us, and the White House interviewed both of us, and I was selected. And it was just a thrill and an honor to be there to serve any president. It's an honor to work at the White House under any president, but I was there under President Reagan, who I greatly admired, and my four-year assignment was 3.5 years with him and a half year with President Bush, 41. And what we did, I was a commander of a 62-person unit that provided all the sound, the lighting, the podium, the flags, the seal of the president. We'd always give a new young guy the job of putting the seal on because they'd be so nervous.
Right.
But they didn't realize when the president had been announced, nobody's looking at the guy putting the seal up. They're looking at the president. And so we had fun with that. But it was very serious business because you can't have any mistakes. We also fed the sound directly to the media. Of course, there's only one microphone now under President Trump. At that time, we had two on the podium. That cable runs to what's called a multiple box that the media plugs in their sound cable. And it will be as clear as if they had their own mic on the podium. You've seen podiums covered in mics. You can't have that with a president. So we fed them the sound, which they didn't like. They want to have their own mic up there, but they can't. We also provided the speech prompter. We, some other cats and dogs, anything AV, we provided to the president. And as my boss said, that's the stuff that can go wrong and get him in trouble with Nancy Reagan. Whereas if something more serious, like a secure phone or something went out, nobody knows about it. You know, they
right.
just fix it. But it was very thrilling. Out of 850 people in the White House Communications Agency, I had a job where I was around the president almost on a daily basis. And I've got a lot of pictures with him and things like that.
Can you tell us about maybe the most exciting event that happened to you besides just meeting the president while you were there?
Yeah. Well, there were many, many. The night that Princess Diana and Prince Charles were there was very exciting. We had been told by Mrs. Reagan that she was going to ask Neil Diamond to sing. Now, he wasn't there as an entertainer, and so she didn't want to look like she presumed he would sing, so we couldn't have the sound system set up. She wanted us to have a little portable one out of sight. So anyway, one of my sergeants, you know, I told him to set this up, and he did. And I said, Tom, why don't you show me, you know, where it is and... Oh, it's very simple. I know it's simple, but just show, oh, I'll take care of it. Don't worry. Let me look at it. So anyway, it was in the usher's office. I don't know if you've ever heard of the usher, but they're the ones that maintain the mansion itself. So we go, and sure enough, it was simple. Pick up this speaker stand and microphone. You go and plug it in. But it comes time to do it, and Tom was nowhere to be seen. So Mrs. Reagan, you know, wanted that right away. She right. asked if Neil Diamond would sing to Princess Diana because she was a big fan of his. So fortunately, I was able to do that very smoothly. I'd hate to think if I was doing it for the first time, you know, fumbling. And then handed Neil Diamond the microphone, and then he sang to the princess as close as you and I are. She put her hands up on his shoulder, and they sort of danced in place.
Wow.
And you never see any of those pictures because Buckingham Palace doesn't allow the release of those pictures, although I think I could get a hold of them now. That's one of my to-do list things. But she was thrilled with Neil Diamond. Neil Diamond was nervous, as these stars often are. They're nervous around royalty. So he handed me the microphone back, and then somehow he must have been asked to do another one. So I said, don't worry, you're doing great.
Could you tell us a little bit about the time with the President Reagan's famous take down this wall? And were you there, or how did you deal with that?
That, of course, was at the Brandenburg Gate in West Germany. I was not there, but I was watching on TV. And when he said that, I felt embarrassed for him. I thought, gosh, that's a very audacious thing to say. But remember the sentence, everybody remembers that, but the sentence before that, they were talking about openness and glasnost, I believe it's pronounced.
Yes.
All the openness. And he said, Mr. Gorbachev, come to this gate. And then the next sentence, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And it gives me chills every time I hear it or think about it. And my guys were there, and they said that everybody cheered him afterwards. Sure enough, the wall came down later. But they both respected each other. Remember, they had met at Reykjavik, Iceland, and had gotten along well, very well together, and agreed to meet again. It was funny. I really would have liked to have gone on that Reykjavik meeting, because I've always wanted to go to Iceland. But that trip left to set up while I was in Raleigh working a visit by President Reagan downtown, who was speaking on behalf of a candidate running for Congress, and I can't even remember who it was. But we had a policy at the White House Communications Agency where, if it were all possible, you could work events in your hometown. And so I was in Raleigh when that Reykjavik team left for Iceland from Washington. Which reminds me of another point on travel. The president's in Raleigh, and people don't realize, but there's plane loads of equipment going to somewhere like Reykjavik. Or let's say the president speaks in Dallas tomorrow, Houston the next day, and Los Angeles the next day. That's three big teams out on the road with limos and airplanes and helicopters, and we'd have about 40,000 pounds of communication equipment if it were a big job on lighting and sound, like it was for the Space Challenger speech given at the Johnson Space Center in Texas. That trip alone had 40,000 pounds of lighting and sound equipment. Now, Gorbachev came to the White House in, I believe, November of 87. And one of my other best memories is announcing he and the president into the room to sign it. That is to sign the INF Treaty, the treaty to limit the amount of intermediate nuclear weapons in Europe. Very serious business and a very historic event in history for these two world leaders to agree to limit nuclear weapons. And it was a particularly mouthful to say. It was, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States and the General Secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Notice I still have that engraved in my pea brain.
Of course.
But you've spent all week setting up for all this and the nerves. And it was such an awkward sounding announcement. I asked the person in charge to initial that was the correct announcement they wanted. I didn't want to risk making an error of that magnitude. We never hear the end of it, for sure. And then you have to count the ruffles and flourishes, because you don't want to say it too early or too late. Well, I'm standing there getting my nerves together. Gorbachev leans over and whispers something to me, and I look up at the interpreters as if to say, what did he say? Well, neither interpreter was paying attention. Neither Gorbachev's interpreter or Reagan's interpreter were paying attention. They were looking at President Reagan's Gene Autry watch that he was showing. About that time, the Marine band started, dun da da dun da da da, and you would count those ruffles and furs on your fingers like this. Dun da da dun da da da, dun da da dun da da da, dun da da dun da da da, dun da da dun dun dun. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States and the General Secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Dun, dun. And that was just very thrilling. Normally, I didn't do the announcements. I was in charge. That was another one of the cats and dogs. But I let my younger guys do that so that, because it was thrilling. But on that one, I said, I'm going to do this one myself.
Did you ever find out what he said to you?
I never did. A Secret Service agent told me it was probably something off color or risque or maybe just ridiculous to see what my reaction would be. Probably he wanted to see if I understood Russian. We assumed all their advanced people were Soviet agents. And he probably wanted to see if I were likewise in intelligence, to see if I understood Russian, something like your zipper's down maybe, or you've got a spot, just something that I would see how I would react. And
could you tell us then you went on to the Pentagon? What did you do there?
Well, remember I said I was in the audiovisual service. The rumor was that I was going to be given a squadron in San Antonio, Texas, but it wasn't open yet. It wouldn't be open for a year. So they thought they'd put me in the Pentagon for that year, and then I would go on to that slot. Well, while I was in the Pentagon, I ran into a general who was the new commander of the Air Force Special Operations Command. I only knew him through my wife because she had worked for him. And he said he came to the Pentagon and he said, Frank, I need a public affairs officer. And I said, I've always wanted to be in public affairs, but I'm not a public affairs officer. And he said, that's okay. We'll figure it out together. So in that instant, my life was changed again from being a squadron commander to being the first director of public affairs for Air Force Special Ops. So I said, now we got to find Caroline something. And the general turned to his aide and said, is that director of administration still open? And he said, yes. He said, put Caroline in that. So in 5 minutes, I got 2 assignments taken care of. And when you're married to a fellow service member, that's always your biggest worry is being separated.
Right.
And so that kept us together. Again, we never were separated. We managed to stay together the whole time. But that was a very, in many ways, a bigger thing in my life than the White House because I'd wanted to get into public affairs. And so I did that there for the Air Force Special Ops Command. And then I did it again at Hill Air Force Base, Director of Public Affairs for a very large organization there. In fact, that's why I stayed in the Air Force. I was going to get out at 20. But I wanted to stay in to go to Hill Air Force Base again, where my wife and I had met and married.
Could you tell us a little bit about what is a director of public affairs? Especially for us novices, we'd be more than interested to know what that involves.
That's an excellent question. In the government, we don't have public relations because we're not supposed to try to influence the public. But we do educate the public, and it may sound like a difference without distinction. It's the same toolbox. We use the same tools, knowledge of journalism. But public affairs has 3 legs in the military. It's media relations, dealing with the media, and like any large organization, you have a lot of interface with the media on both good news and bad news. It's employee communications, again. Any large organization has that. We had a 20,000 civilian workforce there at Hill Air Force Base. We published a base newspaper with a circulation both on and off base of about 32,000 copies per week. And I had 2 employees that did that. And then what we call community relations, we're usually the largest employer and whether we are or not, we still want to have a good relationship with the community. And so we have, and there are a lot of social and business relationships with the leadership of the base and the downtown folks. Probably one of the best in the Air Force is at Hill Air Force Base, a wonderful experience.
Well, you asked about what your, you mentioned you didn't have experience. What did you learn from jumping in the frying pan without the experience? What piece of knowledge do you wish you had before you jumped in?
That's a great question, too, because I tried to talk my boss out of, I was set up to go to the Defense Information School at Fort Meade, Maryland, where they train those officers heavy in journalism and writing and national security and things like that. And to his credit, he said, no, you need to get that to have credibility with your colleagues. But I thought I didn't need it because I had worked in radio and news and had a very good understanding of event planning and stuff like that. But anyway, I went to the school and I realized that I didn't know everything. I thought I knew everything, but and the school was very wonderful. And after I retired, I ended up going back to that school and teaching for better part of 9 years. So you asked what did I not know? I think I had a good feeling for messaging, but I didn't understand the proactive crafting of messaging. I mean, that's a skill in itself.
Could you explain to us that aren't familiar with the military why it's important to get your public relations message correct and why it took such a large team of people to support the military in their public relations, kind of community relations type of area?
What's most important about what we do is we owe a stewardship to the people who pay the salary, to the citizens. And that's why we never lie and we never mislead with the truth. Sometimes, especially politicians, that what they're saying is true, but they're misleading the way they're framing
right.
it. And that's why we have open houses. That's why congressional delegations take tours. The public takes tours. And we owe it to the American people to let them know what we're doing and what we're doing for them and how we're spending their money.
Could you tell us, is there any other interesting stories that you'd like to share with the group about what your experience after 22 years in the military?
Well, the whole thing was, I never thought I'd stay in. You know, Raleigh wasn't a big military town. It still isn't, but when I was in college, I just didn't know much about the military at all. I think Beetle Bailey cartoons in the paper was my impression of the military. And so when I went in to ROTC at NC State, I never thought I'd be going for a career. I thought that I would be in radio. In fact, on my graduation day, I got offered a job as news director of a small station in Reidsville, North Carolina. As I went on, I really enjoyed what I was doing, and I enjoyed my assignments. I enjoyed all of my bosses and colleagues for the entire 22 years, and I consider it was an honor to serve.
Can you tell us, you were offered a radio station in Reidsville. What made you go into the military instead?
Well, I at that point, I didn't have a choice. I'd just been commissioned hours earlier and got this call from the radio station. And then at the five-year point, oftentimes officers at the five-year point, you're a captain, you just made captain, you're feeling like you can conquer anything. I was thinking about getting out and going into TV news, and I did an audition for WRAL, and they actually offered me a job covering Durham, but they said I could only hold it for 2 weeks. Well, at that time, it was impossible to get out of there. Military in 2 weeks. And I was in Las Vegas then working in a video production studio and just, you know, doing some wonderful things for fighter pilot training and exercises and things like that. So I really thought, well, I'll just put that off. I can do that later.
Can you expound a little bit more on the video production you did for fighter pilots? That sounds very interesting.
Yeah. The Air Force's fighter weapons school is at Nellis, and you hear of Top Gun all the time at the Navy, and the Air Force's is called the Fighter Weapons School. And we made a series of videos on fighting maneuvers and how to do them. We made lessons learned from a big exercise called Red Flag, where they go out and it's as close to war as you can get without actually shooting each other down. They had electronics. You know, back then they were nothing like you would have today, but we had electronics where they were able to do dogfighting and score it and see it played back. And rather than talking over the bar about who shot who down, you could show objectively who shot who down. And it was a great thrill working with those guys. They're a unique group of people, fighter pilots are.
Oh, yes. Yes, they have some egos from what I understand, but I'm sure they deserve that.
We want them to.
Yeah. Yes. Is there anything else, any other stories you'd love to share with our audience? I'm sure we'd love to hear more about your time, even at your last station at Hills Air Force Base.
Well, at Hill, we were under scrutiny for about 2 years by what was called the BRAC, the Base Realignment and Closure Commission, and they're looking at places to close. We had been told that we were going to be chopped, but at the same time, the BRAC Commission said that they were going to be fair and they weren't going to let politics enter into it. And so I came up with the slogan for my boss to say, based on the merits, we'll win. Because we actually did have the strongest workforce in the Air Force of the five places that did what we did, and that is tear apart and rebuild and refurbish airplanes. And so against all odds, we beat that. I suggested that the general invite some of the commissioners out to the base, and they did come out and see for themselves the quality of work being done, and we were not on the chopping block. In fact, we grew after that.
Well, thank you very much, Frank, for sharing your experiences. We really do appreciate it. This is Janet Schanzenbach, Director of Community Relations with the Triangle Radio Reading Service.
Thank you, Janet. And that's going to end our broadcast for today, this edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after our broadcast on our website, triangleReadingService.org. Salute a Veteran Every Day is underwritten by RBR Physical Therapy. Are you in pain or in discomfort? Start your journey of relief at RBR Physical Therapy, located at 1300 Corporation Parkway, Suite B, Raleigh. Call 919-917-7729 for more information. Visit www.rbrpt.com. Limp in, leap out. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Frank Urban for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. See you next time.